Thanks everyone for coming. You said last but not least, I mean, in all seriousness, I probably am least in terms of expertise on Bhopal, and I'm really, I don't usually say this honestly, but I'm in this case exceedingly humble to be with these individuals who have really taught me about Bhopal, and as I think I'll make clear, my intention in this talk is not so much to talk about the scientific detail as to sort of step back and discuss the title and what's behind that, and I'll explain that. But again, first, thank you, Ramana, and it was great to meet Dr. Moulay on this trip for really all that you've done and for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. So this was the title that I guess gave myself several months now ago when Dr. Dara first asked me to speak. And the journey in the last several months until today has been a really important one and an interesting one to me, and one that made me even question the title, which made sense at the time and will still allow us for, I hope, a good discussion. But now I've modified it. And I'll explain why I put the question mark and why I said and elsewhere, because this talk, again, I want to have us provoked to think about not only Bhopal, but how this relates to other contexts and how we can learn going forward. And so I'm going to read this, and it's going to become clear why I use this quote to start. This is from a British, born in Australia, but working for years in Cambridge and Oxford, Professor May, Robert May. And he's a very prominent scientist. He's actually not only in the Royal Academy of Sciences, but he's been the chairman of it, which is sort of like the top of the top when it comes to science. And he said this, that the role of the scientist is not to determine which risks are worth taking or deciding what choices we should take, but the scientist must be involved in indicating what the possible choices, constraints, and possibilities are. The role of the scientist is not to decide between the possibilities, but to determine what they are. It's a bit of redundancy there, I suppose, but I'm just giving a direct quote. And I'm also not saying that I agree with this. I want to use this talk to get us to think about it, and we can all decide for ourselves. But it's interesting that it's such a, in the scientific sense, powerful and influential person felt this strongly about it. And so that led me to this book, which Dr. Pilkey of the University of Virginia wrote with this provocative title, provocative if it's not obvious, because using the word honest to describe this position that I'll show you shortly, it in a way implies that there may be dishonesty in other positions, which I don't think was his intention, but you'll see what I mean about how that's a very provocative, for lack of another word, title. So this is what I've made this slide, but it's essentially exactly what Dr. Pilkey lays out in his book. So he talks about the role of science in the context of something that's policy or politically related, which I guess arguably is any topic that certainly in this meeting as public health oriented people are involved with, but certainly Bhopal, as we'll get to. The first branching point, as you can see, is whether the decision to, now this, there's a lot of academic language here, which is taken from the book, but let me just try to explain what I think is intended here, that when the decision at hand for the scientist is something that is generally, when he says values, consensus, and low uncertainty, is generally something that people agree is important. They generally agree with the framework. They generally agree what needs to be done. And the science is generally not particularly complex or controversial. Then we go to the left, and we decide whether this is even a policy-related topic. Which, again, for most of us, probably it is, but in some cases, it's really not. And if it's not, then essentially the role is as a pure scientist. You're basically just providing data. It's very straightforward. On you go. If there is a policy-related matter, you're still on the right where it's not particularly complex or controversial, but you're becoming a science arbiter, where basically you're saying, you know, here's the data and here's what it tells us to do policy-wise. Now, I'm going to spend more time on the right, where I've been struggling, and this is where there is a complexity of values and multiple stakeholders, and I'm paraphrasing from the book. But a certain degree of uncertainty that needs to be resolved. And there are two options according to Pielke, and one is where you essentially do not diminish the scope of choice, meaning you lay out all the options and you lay them out as broadly as possible, and they call that the honest broker, again, provocatively. And if not, if you're narrowing the choices and essentially saying, you know, these are the one or several of the multiple options we should pursue, then you're an issue advocate. Now, when I went to Bhopal, and again, I want to repeat that my involvement is not nearly as great as them, so I'm speaking from a really rather narrow involvement. But when I went in 2000, as I'll show you shortly, I was a naive, just barely out of medical school, although well-motivated individual, and I really just wanted to go there and collect data and do science. So I did in 2000. I was invited. Well, what I really did is I asked to be invited, and then I was, that request was accepted. In the sense that I was formally invited, ultimately to do this work, which was important to them to measure lung function, and to me it was science. It was, let's measure lung function, let's document it, and move on. Now, there was a technical issue with the spirometer, and we essentially determined that, at least I did, that the data was not going to be usable because it was, at that point, I couldn't calibrate it, I didn't know how, and I couldn't get the help I needed. But there was a sense, at least among a portion of the individuals involved, and one in particular perhaps, that was not absolutely critical, because there was a sense that the way I reflect on it, perhaps subjectively, although this is a direct quote, there was a sense that there was an important mission to document in spite of technical difficulties. From my perspective, I just wasn't comfortable with that, and so I essentially dropped out of that project and left the clinic. And then ever since, really, I've been wondering what the best thing is, following the others' experiences from a distance, really. I thought that this put me in the position of trying to be an honest broker, meaning let's show what all the options are and not really push one way or the other. So I was hoping to be down in that quadrant. However, as the few years went by after that, I found myself torn between essentially just giving options versus a sense of priorities. So I was torn between the bottom two of that figure. And I ended up writing two perspectives, which are really just that, opinions and perspectives rather than data-driven papers. One was called this, building off a previous paper that had been done earlier by a medical student in Bhopal. So it was sort of a play on that earlier title. But anyway, it was published in the Indian Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine in 2002. And the gist of that really was that I was sort of taken aback by what I saw as a lack of quality in just the general medical care for this community, completely aside from the disaster and all the real suffering and disease, obviously, you've seen some of it, that was present. But I was just shocked by, in spite of that, what I conceived as suboptimal general medical care. So I made that point. And then on the research side of things, I was really struggling with how much should the focus be on Bhopal specifically versus what that could tell us more generally so that there was not another Bhopal. So in other words, how much should be on the specific MIC effects, undoubtedly important, versus what we can learn that's not related specifically to MIC, which of course theoretically would help other situations that are not specifically MIC related. And I relayed that that thought in this paper the following year. But by then, clearly, I think by this framework, which I wasn't aware of at the time and I've only read since, I was inevitably an issue advocate because based on that last slide, I was essentially not just saying, here are the choices you decide. I was saying, here are the options for how we move forward, and here's where I see some priorities that at least at the time I thought made sense. So since then, I've been in my broader work, I've been thinking about what do other figures in that I respect in the world tell us about this, or what can we learn from other examples. And so you'll see for several slides this idea that you can be an influential scientist, whether you're in public health, in quotes, or not, whether you think you're in public health or not, but that doesn't necessarily fit this honest broker terminology, and yet you can obviously be doing a very large amount of good for society and science and public health. So I just wanted to start, there'll be three different examples with this person and wondering, these guys presumably know because they've seen these slides, if they remember, who this is. Does anyone know? It's an air pollution related person. I'll tell you that because I know this is not like strictly air pollution related crowd. So this one's a little bit obscure. It'll get easier, I think. This is Arden Pope. And in the air pollution world, I would personally say the most influential epidemiologist of our time, certainly. And it was interesting. I had him in Vancouver once, and this one's paraphrased, but it's very close to this, that he told me on a cab drive as I was struggling, and this has been really ever since Bhopal with this you know, where do I fit between science and advocacy. He's on one extreme, I suppose, where he says, again, paraphrasing, Chris, you know, I stay away from policy. I really stay actively away from policy. I'd like to do it. I'm sort of drawn in a way, but I really stay away because the attacks that result basically being called an advocate rather than a scientist are essentially more hassle than they're worth. I've attempted to go there, but I can't because it's gonna basically bite me, and I just have to stay away from that. And there's a whole story there, but I won't go further into it. So the second example, this one should be a bit easier. Does anyone know who this is? You get the X-ray and everything, and if you squint, you can see his name on the wall, and he's a famous guy, and his name's Irving Selikoff. Didn't you say you're in New York? Well, you know, he's from New York too, but that doesn't mean you have to know him, obviously.
But as a moderator, I have to keep my gob shut when you speak.
Thank you. Following protocol. So anyway, Irving Selikoff, so he's a different example. He's someone who, as I'll show you in the next slide, or I'll show you right now, in the 1940s really was a huge and influential figure in the epidemiology of documenting the hazards of asbestos, and was basically operating as an epidemiologist, happened to be regarding asbestos, and published many papers that were critical and have over and over again been proven to be correct. But later in his career, he became an advocate. It wasn't a night and day thing, but he transitioned over time from being more of a straightforward scientist to more of an advocate. And he said late in his career, this, 40 years ago, I was under the same misapprehension as many scientists and doctors. Our task was simply to obtain knowledge and information that could be used for human good. And like not that Arden Pope was thinking of Selikoff, but in general, the comparison can be made that Selikoff was essentially attacked just the way that Arden Pope would fear that he could be. The good news of this story, although is extremely painful and challenging and time-consuming and exhausting for Selikoff, is that he was essentially vindicated because all of his science by other people has more or less been proven correct. But there was the additional burden on him that he was constantly having to fend off this attack. Okay, how about these guys? This one's even easier. You don't have to squint that much. You just have to have decent vision, and you can see that back there. Right, somebody's got to. Can you read that? Very good. All right. Yeah. So Tom or something.
Tom Paul
is on this one. So very good. There you go. So this is yet another example, a sort of a different variety of these ways of dealing with this challenge, generally speaking. And I think what's interesting about these individuals is they were clearly advocates, but they, different from Selikoff, they weren't really the scientists who developed the knowledge base that was needed. They simply took the knowledge base and went with it as advocates, and ultimately, on behalf of a whole huge group of individuals, received the Nobel Prize. So now, just wrapping up here before I hope we can have a discussion. Here's where I stand now, and my thoughts are still evolving, as I think you might notice. So, as public health scientists, and I consider myself one of them, this term of honesty, I think, is problematic. I don't really know what Dr. Pielke was intending, whether he meant to be provocative or not. But obviously, we can be honest and still be outside of what might be considered a strict scientific role. And of course, even that, what a strict scientific role is debatable. But I think of that as just generating data, essentially, and not interpreting it in terms of policy. Public health scientists, however, may feel that they're better able to benefit society, and I think Selikov's an example, stepping beyond just that data or even just beyond presenting others' data and options and actually recommending specific action. But, and I think this is important, if they do so, any individual in this position where they're going to move into advocacy, I think they need to be very clear about that, not only in their own minds, but to the others. It may be obvious, but I think they need to be explicit. I think they need to voice or write that they're aware that they're stepping away from the data and into advocacy, just in some way, not only to be utterly transparent, but just to make others aware that they realize that there is this transition. And the timing of doing that, it makes a difference. For Selikov, it led to a lot of emotional stress, and ultimately he was vindicated, but when you do that, at what point in your career is going to make a difference? And I think, and again, this is my opinion, I think we have to realize that does make objectivity more difficult. And you can say that there's no such thing as true objectivity. But relatively speaking, I do think that when we step from a scientific role into an advocacy role, it does make our objectivity about the data more challenging. Not that we can't remain relatively objective and true to the data, but it does pose challenges. But some people, including Selikov, would say that challenge and that strain is worthwhile and even necessary. I didn't use an example, but there's another one about lead scientists who felt like if they didn't move into an advocacy role from the science that they derived regarding lead, that no one else would do it. And that's a conversation I've had with the lead scientists. So finally, my time in Bhopal was relatively brief, and really I didn't contribute, I think, much of anything to science, but I think that it's brought me to the current discussion, and I hope we can have a discussion together about it. And I still feel, even more than 10 years later than that opinion piece, that I haven't been there to witness it, but I was still, I'd still be concerned that as time goes on, primary care, it remains critical, and when it comes to trade-offs of resources, I think we can't forget the nuts and bolts of basic primary care moving forward. So I'm just going to end on this slide, and it's really meant to say that in my work, and anyone that comes to Vancouver is welcome to visit me. This is what we're doing. We're doing a variety of studies that I could talk about another time, but I constantly push my team and myself to make sure that they're going to contribute ultimately to public health, so that none of this is esoteric, and we can all, as Dr. Dar was saying, we can all talk to each other from different disciplines as we move forward. And I'll end with that, and thank you.
Thank you.